Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, Hyperthetical.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of IGN Unfiltered, my monthly-ish interview series. We are back after an unofficial hiatus, and we're not at home base. We are here at 343 Industries in Redmond, Washington, and I am with Joseph Staton, the creative director, the head of creative, officially.
That's right.
Halo Infinite.
That's right.
It is really good to see you, my friend. I've been looking forward to doing this sit down with you for quite some time.
Me too. I'm glad it's finally happened, Ryan. After many years of trying to make it happen, it's good.
Yeah, I mean, you've had a really long and phenomenal career in and around Halo, but also other things, and we're going to cover all that. But I want to start with your love of aviation.
Wow. You
tweet a lot, and you post a lot.
Yep.
So you love to fly. I mean, I'm pretty curious. What is it about that hobby that brings you so much joy? Because it's, you know, not everybody is into going up and learning how to fly and spending time up in the air.
That is true. Well, I just have to say, you might have planned to spend an hour talking about Halo, but now you've just elected to spend an hour talking about airplanes.
That's
so here
fine.
We go.
Let's do it.
No, I'm kidding. In short, aviation has always been a fascination for me. You know, when I was little, building model airplanes or reading books about the Battle of Britain or whatever it was, just captured my imagination, that human ability to create machines that took you up into the air. You know, when you work on video games and you have a family, you don't have a lot of free time. So I deferred that dream of learning how to fly for many years and ended up getting my pilot's license about 5 or 6 years ago. And now, spend my free time doing it. But why I love it so much is it's a challenge that you get better at, that you can increase your mastery, much like video games. But there's a level of manageable risk. I'm not really a thrill-seeker personality, but I do like a little bit of risk in my life. But I love that aviation has great tools for risk management, and it's all about pushing your personal limits safely, coming back safely, all those kinds of things. So, I enjoy the challenge, and I enjoy the mechanics of the airplane. And again, we're going to be talking about this for the next hour,
buckle up, make sure the tray tables are up and they're upright and locked position.
That's right.
Here we go.
That's right.
Is there a favorite flight that you've taken? Like, is there one that stands out when I say that where you're like, oh, this, you know, for whatever reason, there was this one flight I took?
Well, there's certainly memorable flights. And I think if there are any pilots watching this, the ones that you tend to remember are the ones where you thought, you know, that was a really bad decision to go flying today, and I need to do a better job next time of making sure my go-no-go list is really buttoned up, because there are unpredictable things that happen when you fly, whether it's weather or traffic or those kinds of things. So those are the memorable flights that you learn from, but my favorite flights have been with my children, just flying into mountain lakes and camping overnight, and you know, I'm very fortunate to be able to fly and being able to share that with people I love those are the most memorable things to me.
Do you have a favorite plane?
Well, I am a co-owner of a small amphibious aircraft, which means it can land on the ground, it can land on water.
Yeah.
And living in Seattle with the tons of water and different places to fly to, it's super convenient. So yes, I am a amphib aficionado. I'm an amphibious pilot. That's what I love to do.
Now, you're working on Halo Infinite, but was Microsoft Flight Simulator your dream game last year? Was that your game of the year?
Well, my previous job at Microsoft was working for the Xbox publishing team, and so working on Flight and the years that we spent, you know, developing that in secret and then announcing it to the world, I wasn't on the actual Flight team, but as part of the publishing team, was certainly involved in that process. And oh, absolutely! I mean, growing up playing Flight Simulators, it was a huge part of my own evolution as a gamer or simmer, I guess,
right.
one of the same thing, depending on how you look at it. Just to see it come back and in such grand style using all this cool technology. And it was magical to watch it come together. And of course, it wasn't magic. It was super hard, technical, and artistic design work. But yeah, just super impressive that Flight Sim is back, and I have a very good time when I play.
Yeah, you must have been able to bring a pretty unique perspective to that game, both as a player and on contributing on the development side, too.
To a certain extent, although our great partners at Asobo, one of the wonderful things that they did on the project is the vast majority of the people, at least in leadership positions and other people too at their company, went out and got their pilot licenses.
Nice.
So once they started working on this game, they decided, you know what, we really need to understand this, you know, kinesthetically and from top to bottom. And so they went out and learned to fly. So I was not by far the only pilot working on that project.
So another thing I learned about you before this is that you originally wanted to become an actor.
True, kind of, but continue.
So I'm just kind of curious if there was a particular actor growing up or a character or role that inspired you to want to do that.
That's a multi-layered question. So what I really wanted to do when I went to college back in Northwestern, which is a great college and has a really great theater program, is I was most interested in playwriting and just play analysis. I really enjoyed the construction of plays, how they were written, how you interpret them, how you bring them to life, etc. I won't bore you with that story. But I happened to grow up in the Bay Area, very close to a theater called Berkeley Repertory Theater, which is a wonderful American repertory theater. I had an internship there working in the scene shop, and I just fell in love with that whole production of theater, that collaboration to create art. And I came in contact with a number of just great repertory local actors who no one will probably know, but you'll see them, you know, in various TV shows and movies, etc. So I wouldn't call out any one actor, although it delights me to no end that F. Murray Abraham, who I first saw in Angels in America in New York, is now on Mythic Quest, the TV show he plays, what's his name, Longbottom, the author that writes the backstories of the... So here's this super great theater actor that I've watched forever and watched his career, and now he's on the one show on TV that's all about game development.
Yeah.
It gives me, it makes me chuckle every time. He just is able to, like, chew the scenery and chew up his scenes, and he's just awesome in that show.
So anyways,
I don't know. Eventually we're going to get to video games.
We
but
are.
So far this interview is amazing.
Well, that's the idea is that we learn
you
more
lull
about you.
Me into a sense of comfort and ease before you hit me with the hard stuff.
You know, we have a whole month of coverage to talk about the game.
That's true.
I like to hear the stories behind the people that are making the games. That is just as interesting to me. And for instance, there's the time that you applied to work at the CIA.
That's true, but I can't talk about that.
That is, like, how did that come about?
So, yeah. So as you get to know my odd path to where I am today, you know, one of the things that I also had an interest in was military history, diplomacy. Basically, growing up, I just read everything that I could, from high fantasy to sci-fi to history to, and just I had many, many interests growing up. And when I graduated from graduate school, I was looking for something to do that would be meaningful, a way that I could contribute, a way I could serve. And so I applied to a variety of things, the Foreign Service and the CIA as well. Neither one of those things worked out, but fortunately, while I was waiting for those jobs to ultimately fall through, I ended up playing a lot of video games, one of which was a game by a small company named Bungie called Myth.
Yes.
And that is how this whole journey began.
Well, leaving out a stint in there, you worked at your parents' winery in Northern California.
You're just
as well.
Making this more confusing for people.
you've had an interesting journey.
That's true.
Like it's you know, there is no single one way into the video game industry. There are a million different ways, and
that is right.
You know, even.
That's right.
You can take, one person can take four different routes.
That is absolutely right. And my story is definitely one of, I would say, falling into a career in an area, a craft that I loved as a fan first, and then found my own little way in to this actual job. But yes, I mean, to set things straight, my family winery was a very, very small winery. I think when people think about wineries, they think about, you know, Napa Valley and, what was it, Falcon Crest? Was it they in a winery in Falcon Crest, that old TV show? I forget. But it was basically like a farm. We grew grapes, and those grapes happened to turn into wine. But it was a very small family winery. I spent many, many weekends and summers with my family, my dad especially, my brother too, just, I mean, being up in the California wine country. Again, that's a whole other hour conversation.
Yeah. But well, it's a 3-hour show.
Okay, good.
But no, you mentioned that you fell and you started playing Myth, and that's so you ended up playing with the Bungie guys online.
That's right.
But what I'm curious about is, how does that connection happen in the sense that there's no voice chat back then? You know, you're just typing, and do they just say, oh, I'm from the development team, and you sort of strike up? Like, how does that even happen? I'm just fascinated by that.
Pretty much. I mean, the Myth community wasn't, I mean, this is gaming back in the 90s.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many copies Myth sold, but I don't think it was a million. It was probably closer to 100,000. So I don't know what their peak CCU, concurrent user account, was, your average night in Myth, but it was probably in the thousands, or maybe, depending on the time of night, the hundreds. And so, depending on when you were playing, you just ran into the same people. And the development team played a lot because they loved the game, and I played a lot because I loved the game, and I just happened to end up in similar circles. I've never asked Alex Seropian, one of the co-founders of Bungie, if this is true, but I suspect it was true. Alex and Jason Jones, the other co-founder, both went to University of Chicago, where I happened to go for graduate school. Mm-hmm. So I think we got to talking about shared educational background, and that led to other topics, and eventually offered to come out and work for the company. But yeah, I mean, it was just a little group of people, a small group of people, I should say.
Like a dozen people at most at that point in
time? I'm sure it was, oh, the size of Bungie at that point?
Yeah, yeah.
Less than 50, okay. Because they had the Myth team, they had the prototype Blam team, which would become Halo.
Right.
They had a publishing organization, testing organization. So probably about 50 people or so, I would say.
So you find your way, you've now fallen into the games industry.
That's right.
You're working at Bungie.
Yeah.
Here comes Blam. It becomes Halo. I mean, the story's been told a million times about Microsoft coming in and acquiring the studio and the game and all that. But I kind of want to just fast forward a little to something. I've had the privilege of asking some of the other Bungie veterans about this, and I want to get your perspective because I just think it's fascinating. And that is, was there kind of like an oh shit moment when you realized that Halo had become just something beyond successful, like that it was this blockbuster thing? Was there kind of a moment that stands out for you, or did it just sort of happen in a progression enough where you kind of didn't really notice it?
For me, it was more the latter. I think the important thing to keep in mind is we were all really, really busy shipping Halo 1. We were crunching super hard. I was sleeping under my desk. It was a lot of hard work to get that game out the door. Small team, console launch, all those kinds of things. And at the time, Halo was just one of many titles that was contending for, you know, the thing that you had to buy, that killer application for Xbox. There was Abe's Odyssey.
Sure.
There were a whole bunch of other games. And so we knew we had a fun game on our hand, but if I'm sure you recall, our E3 before we launched Halo wasn't super great. Our multiplayer demo had frame rate issues, and I think people looked at us and, you know, squinted a little bit and said, I don't know if this thing's going to land.
Controller,
is going to land super well. So we shipped it. We were all exhausted. And then I remember looking at some of the coverage, the news stories about the launch. And I could be misremembering these details, but I remember, like, Bill Gates handing a console to someone, and Times Square, and a whole bunch of people. The first one, like, waiting in line. And I thought, That's odd. Like, it seems like a lot of people want to play this game. And from there, of course, it snowballed. But until that moment where we saw fans reacting to what we'd made and just, you know, enjoying themselves, having fun, I personally, and I think many people, didn't truly understand the impact that we were starting to have.
Yeah, because there's no social media at that point to get
That's
that
right.
kind of instant
That's
reaction
right.
to
yeah.
it. But, you know, are you... Was there any point where you're like...
You'd have to wait for your next-gen magazine to come the next month to figure out what the heck just went on.
Or official Xbox
magazine. Or official Xbox magazine, true.
You get your demo disc and read all the reviews.
And... Ah, the demo disc. Those were the days. Come on.
Those were really fun days.
They were.
It was, I have many great memories working on that magazine for so many years. And that original Xbox era. And Halo was a big part of that. I mean, I don't know if I've ever told you the story, but like I talk about it on our... IGN Xbox Show Podcast Unlocked. I mean, it was literally the end of every work day at OXM, be roughly 5 o'clock, and usually the instigator would be Frank O'Connor.
Sure.
You'd hear the white sort of splash screens, Bungie logo startup, and then you'd hear Marty's theme.
Yep.
You know, the game had been booted up, and that was the Pavlovian signal to everyone else.
Right.
Close up shop, we're playing Halo for the last half hour to, you know, hour of before everybody goes home.
Yeah, and I think it was that, just to go back to the what we were talking about earlier, that the thing that really clicked for me in terms of, you know, our first really taste of success was that sense of community where we could see groups of people gathering together, lugging their giant CRTs over to their friend's house, plugging in for a LAN party, just... The impact that the game had on bringing people together to compete, to make friends, to have fun, that's when, for me, seeing that small experience that we'd absolutely had inside of Bungie as we were playing the game, just like grow and grow exponentially, this broader sense of the Halo community was what really brought it home to me that we had something, we had lightning in the bottle, now we just had to keep it.
Did, I mean, like, because you wrote most, if not all, of the game, correct? The original?
Well, I think if you're going to put anything on my tombstone, not that you should plan to do that anytime soon, but one of the things I have said for a long time and really deeply believe in is that although I was the writer of Halo 1 and other Halo games, we were all storytellers on the team. Didn't matter if you were an engineer or an artist or writer. We all played a vital part in creating the story that is Halo. So, yes, I technically did the writing, but I was not the only storyteller on the team. We all were.
But did you feel like really confident and good about the story that you'd written? Because obviously, in hindsight, we all now know that we all connected a lot with Master Chief and this universe that you guys created. So, like, were you confident about the universe that you were trying to create when shipping the game, or was it just sort of a thing of, well, yeah, you know, I did my best to do a neat sci-fi thing, and then it just sort of took off? I'm just kind of curious where you were at before you know, the powder keg exploded and it became this blockbuster thing.
Yeah, I'll speak on behalf of all writers in the world. No, I was terrified. I wasn't confident at all. I wanted to rewrite the whole thing. I mean, it was the only thing I could really see this is not entirely true. I'm being a little hyperbolic, but I saw most acutely those flaws and decisions that we had to make to actually get the game out the door.
Yeah.
Like I said, we were a small team working really hard. Production discipline was not our strength at that point. It was, you know, just do what needed to do to get this thing done. And I think, looking back on what we did right is we created a character that many people identified with. They could put themselves into Master Chief's boots behind his anonymous helmet and they could become Master Chief. So yes, I think we succeeded there. I think we succeeded in creating a world that was full of mystery and had some questions we answered, but many more that we left unanswered. It was a large world to explore. There was an interesting cast of antagonists. I think mainly I look at the plot trade-offs that we had to make, the way we wired up the story from mission to mission. Some of the things worked really well, like the flood reveal. But yeah, I mean, we had to make a lot of compromises along the way. And we were still learning as a team. Yeah. Like, how do you actually make an interactive story? It was a challenge that many of us were cracking for the first time, at least under that bright of a spot.
Right. Was it you or Marty or both of you? Who found Steve? I know, you know, the studio was in Chicago
was
and he was a radio guy in Chicago.
That was Marty. I mean, Steve was just one of the people that he had worked with. And we knew that back then we weren't doing any performance capture or even motion capture. It was all keyframed. In some cases, just me, you know, on the mouse and keyboard, like driving characters around to create cinematic animations. But yeah, Marty said, I got the guy. I know the perfect guy. He's got the perfect voice for this character. His name is Steve. And I said, awesome. I got the perfect person for Cortana. Her name is Jen. We went to school together. She's awesome. She's in Seattle. It was just people we knew and respected and knew could do the job really well.
Wow, that's what I love that story.
Yeah.
So other than Infinite, which isn't out yet, it's obviously closest to you at the moment.
Yep.
Do you have a favorite Halo that you've worked on for one reason or another?
Yes, I mean, Halo 3 ODST is my favorite, and not just because I was helping to lead that project, but for me it was, and I think any game developers that are watching will understand this, it was the game that we made in the most stable technology base that we'd ever had. You know, it was Halo 3 ODST. It was built in the Halo 3 engine, very few feature changes. So it was almost entirely a content exercise. And we just had the flexibility to go in and create an experience, a story together that didn't have to wait for the engineers to do all their hard work and, you know, rebuild tools and pipelines, implement big features. All of those things are a wonderful part of game development, but it just makes things challenging. It extends your timelines. So I believe the original charter for ODST was we need it in 6 months. Harold Ryan, our studio head at the time, famously came to me and Paul Bertone, the other project lead, and said, you know, we need it in 6 months. You know, just something like Halo 3, but backwards at night. And we're like, no, we're not gonna do Halo 3 backwards at night, but we get what you're saying. Needs to be efficient. We need to reuse assets. We need to be smart about the new things that we put in.
Yeah.
So we stood up a prototype, and people saw what we were going for and believed in it enough that they said, okay, well, now you got 12 months total. And it turns out at 12 months, for a variety of reasons, we ended up actually getting closer to 18, and we're able to spend those last months just layering on as much polish as we possibly could. So for me, in terms of stable technology, just a really tight, cohesive, happy team, everybody marching forward with the same clear vision, just a really wonderful game to work on, very different than the vast majority of other games that I've worked on. Yeah,
I mean, it must warm your heart, because there are a lot of Halo fans out there cite ODST as their favorite for one reason or another.
Yeah, I mean, I can go on and on about ODST, and I'm definitely not trying to talk too much about something that I love, but it was just an experimental game, too, in many ways. I mean, when you look around you, here we are sitting in the Halo Museum with all these, you know, it's very easy to see the scale and scope of this franchise. And it has a very big fan base, a very passionate and dedicated fan base. And when you're working on a franchise like this, it's challenging to innovate. You know, it's very risky to try new things. We certainly are in Infinite, which is very exciting.
We'll get to that.
But ODST was, I mean, it was a noir detective story. Kind of story that I always wanted to write. The fact that I was able to do it in Halo was, I mean, that's pretty cool. I didn't think that was going to happen in my career. So yes, we as a team seized that opportunity. It was just a lot of fun.
And one more ODST question.
Yep.
The soundtrack is one of the, you know, probably top one or two things people remember fondly about that game. I'm just kind of curious, did the chicken and egg thing, like, did the game influence the soundtrack, or did the soundtrack influence the game as sort of you were developing it?
Well, I'm going to tell the story, and since Marty's not here, he can't fight back and he can't disagree with me, but I'm sure you'll hear about it on Twitter if he does. But the way I recall that it went down is I was talking to Marty, Paul Bertone and I were talking to Marty, and Paul had some really cool ideas for this hub and spoke model design, which mapped well onto the writing ideas I was bubbling on. And I told Marty, hey, Marty, I want to explore noir, you know, in all of its themes and with its tone. And of course, a big part of noir is its soundtrack,
sure.
A jazz soundtrack. And I said, Marty, like, you know, let's talk about jazz and like what we like. And Marty basically was like, you don't need to tell me anything about jazz. I got this. And I'll see. Because Marty is very, you know, compositionally, like, he's, piano is a very strong element in what he does. And I was like, you know, talking about, you know, brass and like, you know, saxophones. And he's like, just calm down, saxophone man. I will figure it out. I got this. Don't worry. But I was like, every time I saw Marty for about 3 months, I was like, hey, remember Smokey Saxophone? And he just like glowered at me over his coffee cup. But to Marty's credit, that's absolutely what he was doing. He was coming up with a very cool soundtrack, leaning into the Smokey Sax, and just a really wonderful union of audio and other creative disciplines. Yep.
Oh, I love that. Yep. All right, so we're moving through your history here.
Yep.
Although, actually, I just technically, I'm going to go back in time for one quick second. Halo 2, you got to answer one of the longest running burning questions that have as a Halo fan. How was Halo 2 supposed to end?
I think I could pretty much tell you that. And actually, the funny thing is, maybe was it last summer? I can't remember. Relatively recently, I was cleaning out my basement, and I found all the old storyboards for Halo 2, including the last level of the game, which was called Earth Ark. The short answer is the last level of Halo 2 contained many of the ideas that became Halo 3.
Yeah.
I think people have heard that story. But one of the key things that happened in that last level was that the Arbiter went into the Earth Ark and learned some essential things about the Forerunners, the place of the elites in the universe, and it was the closure of the Arbiter's, not story, but his cycle from, you know, a place of disgrace and disillusionment and antagonism with the Master Chief to really having his eyes open to the truth and giving him a moment to get on top of that realization and then make a heroic choice to continue. I won't bore you with all those details, but secretly, in my mind, Halo 2 was always the Arbiter's game. It wasn't the Master Chief's game. Halo 3 was meant to be their game together.
Yeah.
But the way we originally crafted the story is the Arbiter's the one who, in the end, ended up getting that big moment of closure. It didn't turn out exactly that way. Master Chief got stuck on a ship and had to finish the fight. But you can see some of those themes, some of that storyline thread through, it became Halo 3.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Halo movie that never happened, to what extent were you involved with that, if any?
So for a couple years, I spent a good amount of time in New Zealand. I want to say that I flew down, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 times, like a good every other month. I and a handful of other people went down to work with Peter Jackson and his companies to first work on a Halo movie, and then later to work through some ideas for a actual Halo video game. It was a wild adventure into the land of Hollywood and movie making, but also just a really wonderful opportunity to, I would hope, learn from each other, learn a lot of good lessons about storytelling and how to break down a plot and create characters, and work with a huge art team in terms of Weta, and on their side, I hope, like, learning about the constraints of video game making and what nonlinear storytelling means, and all those things that we have to deal with. I remember one thing that I said to Peter Jackson and some other people when I were down there, when they said, what do you think is the fundamental difference between making a movie and making a video game? And the best thing I could come up with on the fly was, Mr. Jackson, it's kind of like if you were to let a 13-year-old, or actually a group of 13-year-olds, all armed to the teeth with paintball guns onto one of your movie sets and just like let them go for 45 minutes and then film that. Because it's not entirely true, but it's kind of true, right? Like, you unleash the community, you unleash players into this world that you've created, give them all the agency or a lot of the agency to guide the story however they want, certainly moment to moment.
Yeah.
That's very different than, and they're going to shoot everything everywhere because it's a first-person shooter. It's like, I don't think my analogy was inaccurate. But yes, it was that kind of year or two just spent talking through ideas and trying to better understand how each of us went about, creating what we did.
The video game that you were sort of informal, or at least working on to some extent, those Halo Chronicles, was that the project name?
Halo Chronicles, that's right.
Have you ever talked about what that was?
I don't think we ever have, and I'm not sure if I'm allowed to, but I can say that Paul Bertone and I were working on Halo Chronicles, and when that didn't happen, that's where the whole 6 months, you got to make something else, came to be.
Right.
So that's why we originally only had 6 months for what became Halo 3 ODST, was because we were no longer doing Chronicles. We had to do something else contractually. So.
And then while we're just on the subject, the Showtime TV series that's
yes.
happening now, you know, you're a little busy with a game right
yes.
now, but have you seen any of the... anything from the show
I
yet?
I have. Got to see the first two episodes the other day. Kiki Wolfkill, who's leading up that effort, was nice enough.
Transmedia head.
That's right. Yep, was nice enough to show me a couple of the episodes. Me and some other people. I don't think I can talk about that
Fair
either.
Enough.
But it was cool.
Good. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah. Yep.
So you also have written a couple of Halo books.
That's right.
You wrote Contact Harvest and
yep.
Shadow of Intent.
Yeah.
Contact Harvest, in particular, I went and looked this up, spent 4 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, peaking at number 3.
Wow, who'd I beat?
I did not include.
Dan Brown? Did I beat Dan Brown? Probably not.
Maybe.
I don't know. So.
I mean, number 3, I beat a lot of people.
He's Dan Brown.
But was that a fun process, writing a Halo book compared to, you know...
I'm laughing because, like,
you're laughing.
It's like, I mean, you write, like, no, it was terrible. I mean, it was it was the hardest thing I've ever forced my brain to do.
Yeah.
Was it 100% worth it? Absolutely. Do I look back on it very fondly? 100%. But the actual act of putting my brain through that was incredibly, incredibly hard. The only thing that was harder than that was writing Shadow of Intent, because it was shorter. And I find that writing shorter things is just more mentally taxing. You have to be more efficient, more concise, get to the point. But figuring out how to write a novel, knowing that lots of people were going to read it, was very stressful. I mean, because it was a Halo novel, not because I wrote it, but if it has Halo on the cover, you know a good number of people are going to pick it up and read it. So not only did I have that expectation, but I had high expectations for myself. It was a stressful time. We shouldn't talk about it anymore. No, I'm kidding.
Sounds like you won't be doing another Halo book.
I would. All kidding aside, having done it once or twice, you know, it's like anything. You learn how to do it. I would love to have the free time to just write someday, Ryan.
Yeah.
Someday. Yeah.
Are there any nods, any little Easter egg nods to either of those two Halo books in Infinite? You sneak that in when you come on as the head of creative here?
No, but you never know in the future.
It is a living game now.
That's right. It is a living
game. That's right. So, fast forward. So you're still at Bungie. When Bungie gets its independence from Microsoft, goes out on its own, and the team, you guys all decided you put all your chips...
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow... grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Into all your eggs in one basket, I guess,
right.
Is the better,
that's right.
The better metaphor there, into this thing called destiny.
Right.
So was that an exciting time, having spent the previous number of years working on Halo after Halo? Was it a scary time, both? I'm just kind of curious to hear about your perspective during that era.
Exciting or scary? I would say a little of both, probably. More exciting than scary. It maybe was a little more scary before we had a publishing partner. Once we had the publishing agreement and the money was flowing in, well, then it became more exciting.
Yeah.
And then you just got to work. You didn't have to worry about how are you going to pay to keep the lights on. So I'm taking a moment to think about it because I'm trying to think about the similarities between the beginning of Halo, which is to say one of the most exciting times in a game are those early months or years of concept development, pre-production. Really trying to figure out what makes the game special. It's a challenging process sometimes as you all sort of roll around trying to figure out what this game is that you're creating. One of my fondest memories of early Destiny days is after we shipped ODST and the Reach team was still working on that game, a small group of people was able to gather together and really start doing that deep concept development of what would become Destiny. We explored lots of different possibilities there. I think we've shared concept art of a high fantasy take on what Destiny would be and a bunch of other things in between. But finally gelling around that idea of fantasy and science fiction combined, which isn't a wholly original idea, of course, but putting our own unique spin on it, the super exciting time as a creative person to start with a big word cloud of ideas and eventually refine it down into what, Destiny became.
So not to turn the interview into a bummer of a direction, but
you, here you go.
Well, no, it's,
I'm just kidding.
But you left Bungie before Destiny shipped.
That's
and
right.
I'm kind of curious
right.
if you're willing to kind of talk about that, because that's, you were the design director.
That's true.
On Destiny.
That's
so
true.
That is not an insignificant decision or an insignificant move. Were the terms good? I mean, you'd been very invested in building this new world. So, what happened for you there?
Well, as you probably noticed over the years, I haven't talked about that much. And if you talk to anybody from Bungie, you know that there are certain reasons why we can and can't be completely transparent about those details.
Yeah.
But look, game development is like any tough creative endeavor where sometimes the personalities just don't work out, And I think it's especially hard on everybody when you've been colleagues for many years and friends in some cases for many years. And leaving a company is one thing, but leaving behind friends and relationships is definitely much more challenging.
Yeah.
But I think the one thing that I can say is I would say it ended about as well as it could. And I still have many friends who work on Destiny, many friends at that company, and I only wish them the best.
Now, you probably had a lot of choices. You'd been in your resume was very impressive at that point in time. So when you are a free agent, as it were, I would imagine that you had plenty of people knocking on your door. You chose to come back to Microsoft.
That's right.
In 2014 in the studio level kind of creative position,
yeah.
kind of looking at
yeah.
a lot of different games in the everything in the yeah. in the portfolio. So what attracted you to that?
Well, I have to say, when I left Bungie, the first person who got in contact with me was Bonnie Ross, head of 343, which was very kind of Bonnie. And I can't remember exactly what she said, but she said something like, look, I know you don't want to come back and work on Halo, probably, but would you be open to just coming and talking to various studio heads and seeing if there's a fit for you at Microsoft? And I said, yeah, absolutely, love to do that. Thank you, Bonnie. So as I was looking and talking to other companies, I went and spoke to everybody. But the group that most appealed to me at that time and the group that eventually gave me the offer was the publishing team. Going back to what I said about Bungie previously, at Bungie, I was working with the same people on the same game for 15 years. We were making first-person shooter Halo games for a very, very long time. And as I reflected after I left Bungie about how I wanted to grow and get better at what I do, I realized, and this may sound overly simple, but I just needed to meet new people. I just needed to go and look at different studios, large studios, small studios, to see what challenges they were trying to tackle, how they overcame them, learn from other creative people in the industry, be exposed to new ideas, new ways of thinking. And the publishing team offered me that opportunity to, travel around the world, work with great partners like Platinum, and people that I never would have met if I'd stayed at Bungie, and learn from them. And so the 5 years I think I spent in publishing was a wonderful opportunity for me to expand my horizons, and I think better prepare myself for the job that I'm doing now. Quite frankly, I don't think I would have nearly as strong set of skills that are needed for this head of creative job had I not gone and spent those 5 years in publishing and learned from other creative leaders, gone through tough decisions like canceling a project, deciding not to move forward with a project, all the way to the other end of the spectrum, like watching games succeed beyond expectations. Working on Halo for a long time, you sort of begin to expect success
yeah.
and things to a certain extent. Then I'm talking about old school Bungie Halo days.
Right.
Maybe a little sense of entitlement creeps in and you begin to get a little bit too comfortable, I would say. You become less scrappy, less willing to innovate. You don't have to sing for your supper as much anymore. And being with teams at a different point in their evolution was super inspiring to see their passion and how hard they worked and the tough, tough choices they had to make. Fortunately, I was in a position to help them, with resources, financing, marketing support, all those kinds of things. And I guess to make a long story short, it really rekindled that fire that I had for being a little more scrappy, being a little bit more innovative, being more self-critical, looking at a big project and asking, what can we continue to do to bring novelty and excitement to our community here.
Well, kind of on that note, the next time you were the public face of something since the Bungie days when you were, mm-hmm. We'd see you on stage for
yep.
various things, was Crackdown 3.
That's right.
That was a game, yeah,
yep.
you ended up coming in on. So what were some of the challenges from that game? Because we know that the whole cloud powered thing
right.
that was a very ambitious
that's right.
thing that that demo was from let's see I have looked 2015 is what mm-hmm. I have it and then the final game 2019 so
yeah
what can you kind of talk about that in terms of that's a game like Xbox fans really wanted
yeah.
to be great and wanted to love there were so many of these positive memories of the original
right. yeah
and like wow this you're gonna do cloud powered yeah. destruction that'll be neat and
yeah
and I know game development's really hard I only have an inkling of it as somebody who covers this stuff I've never actually made a game but
yeah
I'm wondering if you can kind of speak to the that was arguably maybe your the first kind of I don't want to say failure but that not
yeah.
that not
yeah.
big success
yeah.
you'd had that
yeah.
for years
mm-hmm.
at Bungie with the Halo games.
That's right. Crackdown I mean, it has its own connection to Halo back in the day. And it was a game that had been kicked off before I joined the publishing team, and I think was one of the maybe not the last game that shipped before I left publishing. I think the last one was Tell Me Why, but Crackdown shipped like 2019, so one of the last things in my tenure there. So there's always been a tension at Xbox, but both a tension and an opportunity, which is we are a giant trillion-dollar technology company, right? At the same time, we're an entertainment company. And it's very tricky, but there's also opportunity there to keep those two priorities synced up. And sometimes they don't sync up exactly right, but when they do, it's very, very special, and it's something that only Microsoft and Xbox can do at scale.
Right.
Crackdown's ambition was to be this union of this cloud-powered technology and really innovative game design. And I think in a lot of ways it did succeed as a proof point that this is possible. But along the way, like many games, you have to make compromises.
Sure.
And things don't always turn out exactly how you planned. And the Crackdown conversation, we could probably spend an hour just talking about that. But for me, my big takeaway was, although you don't always get it right, to work here at Xbox is to always, as a creative person, keep your mind finely attuned to those opportunities to harness the power of Microsoft, big technology, and create really novel and engaging experiences that just, like I said, are just frankly not possible to create anywhere else. So it was a tough lesson to learn on Crackdown, but I do not regret at all going through that process because I learned so much.
So as a writer yourself, are you someone who reads the reviews on your own games? I know some developers do and some don't, so I'm just kind of curious.
I do, but I'm not. I think earlier on in my career, I certainly did. I think as you get older and you get like scarred tissue, callous, thick skin, I don't read them to like make myself feel
right to
better about
anything.
Things. To validate things, yes, exactly. What I do is I read whether it's a news review or a user review, maybe even more than a formal press review, is to really understand why customers are either enjoying this experience or not. I'm very clinical when I read reviews these days. As I try to extract common themes, sets of data that sort of are coalescing around one central point. I'm pretty good these days about just stripping all emotion out of reviews and just going directly to, okay, what's positive, what's negative, what can we improve, what can we not improve? And I think being in that mindset, especially as you embark on a live game, on a service-based game, as much as possible, you've got to take the emotion out and just get really crisp, really quick on the pivots you need to make. And reviews are a great place, one of many great places to see some of that info.
So let's talk about that live service game.
Finally,
you're not here for your health.
That's right.
It's been like 45 minutes of not Halo Infinite. So let's talk some Halo Infinite now.
All right, let's do it.
I'm curious, again, you've been in publishing.
Yes.
Not sort of as much with boots on the ground development.
That's right.
So who makes the call to bring you on formally to Halo Infinite? Is that something where you pick up the phone? Does Bonnie call you? Because she had called you years before.
Right.
So how did you end up here, I guess, is what I'm curious to know.
Well, I don't think Bonnie's going to be, I don't think I'm going to get in trouble for telling this story. So I think I can tell you this story.
But I can already tell it's going to be a good story. Then.
Well, I don't know.
If you're wondering if you should tell it.
It does involve an airplane, though, so we can like take it all the way back full circle.
Exactly.
So, quite literally, I was sitting in the cockpit of my airplane, a very hot day, late in the summer, and the Halo demo, I can't remember what it was called. Internally, we call it the Ascension demo, the first gameplay demo that was not this past summer, but the summer before, 2020.
Yeah.
Thank you. Had come out and didn't land as well as we had hoped. And so because Bonnie and I are just, in contact with each other, I just reached out and said, hey, Bonnie, if there's anything I can do, hey, sorry, you heard about the demo. If there's anything I can do to help, just let me know. And over the years, help has been, I would just come in and, you know, talk to people about the game, or just, you know, go out and get drinks with Frank O'Connor, and, you know, just one of my friends, and just talk about Halo stuff. Well, so I had the conversation with Bonnie in the, you know, cockpit of my plane, and then, you know, I went away for 2 weeks. When I came back, you know, help had turned into a totally different scale of what I thought help might be. And I remember opening up my laptop after, I think I was on vacation, and I just had like all this mail in my inbox about a developing plan to explore, you know, what would it be like for me to leave publishing and come over and really help the Halo team. But it just makes me chuckle because, I'm happy to help. Quickly turned into a brand new career. But I was super excited to do it. A real honor, and just grateful that Bonnie thought it was a good idea to give me this gig.
Did you ever think you would officially come back and work on Halo again? Was it a thing you had in the back of your mind, like, yeah, maybe someday, or had you pretty well sworn it off after Bungie separated from Microsoft?
Here's the thing. The way I said goodbye to Halo was thoroughly pleasant.
Was that, or are we talking about that the text at the end of Halo Reach?
The Reach, less so Reach for me. I mean, I did work on Halo Reach, but ODST. I mean, it was this, I don't know how many times in life one gets the opportunity to have a company come to you and say, hey, just make whatever game you want. Just get it done in 6 months and then actually be able to make that game and then spend another number of months. Just this amazing experience to work with a great team, to tell a story, create an experience, and be able to put Halo on the shelf in a...
On your terms?
Yeah, in our terms, I would say. And, I mean, look, this is a tough business. I mean, studios don't hit their milestones, they don't get funding, they shut their doors. I am very aware how fortunate we all were back in the day to have the support of Xbox, be able to ship these games, have people play them, love them, demand more of them. That's a really, it's a privilege to have that opportunity. And I did not take that for granted when we made ODST and Reach. And we were able to say goodbye, I think, as a studio to Halo in a really productive, creatively wonderful way. No one took it away from us. No one ripped it out of our hands. We were able to say goodbye on our own terms, as you said. And so I only had pleasant memories of Halo. And I always thought in the back of my mind, you know, maybe I'll go back someday. And that's when I wrote the Shadow of Intent, the novella, was after we, I think that was that after I came back to Microsoft? I think it was, yeah, back when I came back to publishing. So I always had a sense that old ring would turn and I'd find my way back to it, but I didn't know exactly how. Let me put it this way. It wasn't an opportunity I was actively looking for.
Yeah.
So I genuinely mean when I reached out and said, hey, is there anything I can do to help? I did not expect that would result in this, but like I said, I'm very happy to be here.
So I think, you know, Halo is the Halo fans have been on.
Yeah.
Our own version of this ride as well of,
of
it's been what will ultimately be 6 years between mainline Halo
That's
games.
That's right.
This is a spiritual reboot.
Yep.
We had the creative leads step away from the project prior to your arrival. So, you know, from where the fans are sitting, there's a lot of, okay, well, we hope this is going to be great, but there's some reason for concern here. So I'm kind of curious how to kind of help crystallize it for people. Like,
sure.
how much change have you affected? Like, what has sort of been your guiding principle to the project? Because, you know, there's a lot of work that was done before you got here.
Yeah.
But you've now had this extra year since you've come on board. So I'm just kind of curious if you can kind of sum up, or even maybe you have some specific examples that aren't,
that are
not like top secret story kind of spoilers that you could kind of share of, like, what have you kind of really brought to this this extra year?
So, and I mentioned this before when we were talking before the interview. I think yesterday we were chatting, but I'll say it again in this context, which is when I came in, I took up a couple weeks to get my feet wet, play the game, talk to people, and I came away with three main things, because there were more than this, but three main things where I realized this is how I can actually help. The first thing was to work with other studio leaders and Xbox leaders to get the team more time. When I played the game, I knew right away, oh wow, this is a really great novel expression of a Halo experience. It's a much more wide open, adventure-filled, choice-filled Halo experience, but it feels like Halo. That same DNA is there. It's just a wonderful new version of that. But it needs more time in the oven. We really need to get the team, which is super talented, super hardworking, just get them more time to do what they do best.
So you had come on then prior to the delay?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So you thought you were in this was going to be like a 3-month sprint or something, and then you'd be.
Well, I mean, no, actually, I came in talking with Bonnie and other studio leaders, the conversation really was, let's pause and figure out what we really need to do here.
Okay.
And it didn't take very long to dig in and realize, like I said, the number one thing that would benefit this game and the team is time. Just more time to go after this game.
Which is not a small ask, given that it was supposed to be this big launch title.
It is not. That's right. A huge amount of pressure to stay the course.
Yeah.
And I think a really wonderful example of studio leadership, Xbox leadership, doing the right thing for our fans, doing the right thing for players, even though it hurt, even though there were costs associated with that.
Sure.
It was 100% a player-first decision, and I'm so proud of the studio and Xbox for making that decision. And I was just there to help push that ball. So that's the first thing I help with. And the second thing I help with is really just took stock of mostly the campaign, because the campaign was the area of the two, multiplayer and campaign, where time would benefit it most. The campaign, as you got a chance to see when you played, mm-hmm. is just, we say it's the largest Halo campaign we've ever made. Absolutely is. There's a huge amount of surface area. Multiplayer is great. It's deep. It's super fun. But it just doesn't have that same surface area of campaign. So I focused a lot on campaign, worked with the campaign leadership to decide what are those 10 or so areas where we want to double down? Those areas we already believe are really, really good that we want to make great. We went through a process called EPICS. Just to define those areas of focus that we wanted to go after, and we came up with 10 EPICS. One of those EPICS was that we really want to make sure, and indeed this was our first EPIC, that everybody understands what the equipment is, where to find it, how to use it, how to have fun with it, how to upgrade it, because equipment like the grapple shot was the big addition to the Halo sandbox. It really is like the fourth leg of the three-legged stool of grenades, melee, and weapons.
Yeah.
Grapple shot really is that fourth leg of the stool. So it was one of the epics where we decided to double down, and I helped with that process. That was number two. And the third thing that I dug in on with Bonnie and other leaders was making sure we could finish this game in a way where people were healthy and energized and, as best as we could, ready to move into this live mode, that we finished in a way that was good for the studio, good for our culture, good for our team.
Because you'd lived through the bad versions of that.
That's right.
And being a live game, it wasn't going to just... You weren't going to suffer, and then it'd be over. It would the live service element would it would continue on.
That's right. And we have not done that perfectly. Absolutely, we still have a ton of work to do to get ourselves ready to run that marathon. We're just coming off a sprint, hopefully a healthy version of a sprint, and now we're really taking some time to recuperate and plan for what comes. Next, as a matter of fact, I'm spending the next 3 days at an offsite talking about what comes next in terms of our live service, which is super exciting. But that was number three, is really seeing what could I do organizationally, culturally, leadership-wise to support this team to close in a healthy way. Because I have seen the bad version of that, and I absolutely don't want that for the studio.
And one of the tough choices that you made, which certainly the community doesn't want to hear it,
but... Yep.
And that's the the fact that campaign co-op and Forge aren't going to make it for December 8th. And that I would imagine, based on the conversation we're having, that really, if not entirely, comes down to that third element of team health.
It does. And I'm going to take a deep sigh and drink deep of this last bit of my water. Because, I mean, look, I work on Halo, but I'm still a Halo fan. And campaign co-op is essential to the experience. Playing Halo with your friends is playing Halo.
Yeah.
Whether it's multiplayer or campaign. And so of all the decisions that we made that were the most difficult, delaying co-op was very, very hard. But again, it shows the commitment of the studio, even when it's challenging, even when it hurts, to only ship experiences when they're ready, to only ship quality experiences. And that's so important for any franchise, but certainly a franchise like Halo that's been around for 20 years. If we don't maintain a high bar, if we don't commit ourselves to excellence and commit ourselves to every time we launch something, to delighting our customers, living up to their expectations, ideally exceeding our expectations, I don't think we're doing this job right. And the simple truth is co-op just wasn't ready. And we decided to prioritize our effort in other areas. For example, we made it a priority to make sure that whatever platform you play this game on, whether it's a Xbox One that's 8 years old or a brand new cutting edge PC, that the game is going to be performant, stable, it's going to look great, be super fun, regardless of what piece of hardware you've got in your house. And that was a more important goal than shipping co-op. And that's tough, right? But I think if you look at those two choices and you put yourself in a customer-first mindset, it's clear which one you should choose, even though it hurts. I love co-op. I can't wait for us to ship it.
Do you put pressure on yourself with this project? Are you a sort of self-pressure guy? Because, I mean, I think compared to your previous Halo efforts, this game you come into... maybe you don't agree, and maybe you just don't feel it, but you know, with Bungie, you were kind of always on this wave of pretty universally positive momentum from 1 to 2 to 3 to into ODST. But here, you know, it's been you've got the combination of a long gap. That 6-year gap it's going to be now, which is the longest we've ever gone between mainline Halo games.
Yeah,
and you're coming off of a campaign in Halo 5 that was. Mm. That was not as well liked by certain folks in the Halo community.
Sure,
I'm one of them. It was not my favorite Halo campaign, but so I'm just kind of curious. You know, when you come into this, do you feel pressure for with regard to those things, or do you just not think about it that way?
Certainly, there's the weight of expectation. But I suppose I don't see it as pressure so much as, and I promise you that I mean this, that I really see it as an opportunity to serve. Like, I am here to serve this franchise. We're literally in a museum right now of 20 years of this marvelous experience that a lot of people have contributed to. I am just one person here. And I come in wanting to serve, wanting to do right by our fans, listen to their voice, push back when needed, be here for Xbox and help support the business. I feel very lucky. I feel very lucky. And once you put yourself in that mindset, the pressure in a way goes off.
Yeah.
Because you just lean into what's right for the fans, like what's the best experience, how do we keep people engaged. I don't feel the pressure as much as I feel energized by that opportunity.
Good.
And I haven't felt this excited about working in games for a long, long time. I mean, I started working on Bungie games back in 1998. That's a while ago. I'm turning 50 this year. I hope I've reached a point in my life where I've gained a little bit of wisdom and a little bit of perspective and made some dumb mistakes and hopefully learned from them. But one of the big things I've learned is when you feel pressure, you're probably making a lot more about you than you should. When you feel the weight of expectations, you're probably listening too much to your own self-doubt or your own hang-ups. And when you don't feel that pressure, it means you're doing the right thing, because it means you're listening to other people. Your radar's up, you're attuned to what's new opportunities, new challenges. And so for me, it's a good and healthy sign that I don't feel the pressure. I feel the energy. I feel the excitement.
The last question I have for you is, you know, and this one might be tough to answer now as you're, you know, still just trying to work hard to get to the finish line on Infinite here, but are you going to stick around for a while? Or is, you know, because you said you did say you left publishing, you know, you are full-time here.
That's true.
So is this, you know, is this a permanent thing, or are we just, you just kind of renting right now?
It's what I said before. I mean, I have not felt this energized in a very long time. We've got, which I can't talk about any of this, but we've got so many cool plans that are in the works. And I see such a great opportunity for this studio and Halo to be a driver of innovation again, to be a cultural touchstone, to be a game that people love, a franchise that people love to spend time with. I'm genuinely excited about the opportunity here. But I'm not going to commit to you, man, in this pressure cooker interview. But look, Ryan, I'm totally joking. I'm very grateful to be here, and I'm having a great time.
Love it. Joseph Staton, head of creative on Halo Infinite, along with a very large and dedicated team here at 343 Industries. It's out December 8th. Look for it on Xbox Game Pass, or grab that campaign wherever fine video games are sold.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Ryan. Happy to do it.
Anna Sheridan, New York Times bestselling author of Supernatural Horror. Missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Is the compass broken? Or did I...
Given the circumstances of her disappearance, someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil, so to speak.
Weak radio signal. 700 meters. Closing fast.
There's no place for ghost stories and close encounters in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
Save yourself.
Of course.
What else would it be?
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.